Bienvenidos and welcome to the Histories of Mexico. Episode 4, Tabasco Part 2. The Strong Father Lion. You are listening to the Tamborileros Kun Huacan performing their rendition of the song El Tigre off an album called Región de la Chontalpa. I must also make an addition to my credits, as I forgot to mention Choco Chepe y Tamborileros a Joven as sources for the intro and outro song to this and the first three episodes. My deepest apologies for the mistaken acknowledgement, and please go visit both of these channels on YouTube for a wide selection of music native to the Chontalpa region. That's Tamborileros Kun Huacan and Choco Chepe y Tamborileros a Joven. While on the subject of the intro music, although there are no native tigers found in Mexico, the many indigenous people of Mexico have developed many tiger dances, rituals, and songs, such as this one, likely adopting the name from the European Spanish name for a tiger, and attributing it to the highly revered jaguar that does reside in the country and has a striking similarity to its larger Old World cousin, the same thing likely happening with the lion and puma. These big cats would be immensely sacred to the peoples of Mexico ever since the Olmecs started worshipping and spreading their jaguar cults during the early preclassical. The intro song proudly adds to the legacy of big cat ritual songs that have existed in the region for millennia. Now, with that spot of information out of the way, let's get going with today's show. In our last episode, we discussed the general geographical, environmental, and economic features of tropical Tabasco. In this episode, we will pivot to talk about the historical events that took place in the lands that now make up the state, by following one tribe in particular, the Chontal. It is at this point that the information will begin to get a heck of a lot denser. There will be a lot of names I'm going to begin throwing out at you, and few of them are likely to sound familiar. Do not be intimidated, and do your best to keep up with the tribes and cities. What I am attempting to do is familiarize you with some of the sounds and place names of the Mesoindian world during this pre-Columbian era. Hopefully, by building this early foundation, our later episodes on the Maya and other tribes proper will be easier to discuss and understand. Diving headfirst into the Mayan world before, during, and after the classical period they defined is a very daunting task to both write about and listen to. So instead, we will focus on some lesser-known tribes and events in order to build up our world and be ready to tell the story in its entirety when the time comes. I will also do my best to point out the names and places to remember, and while some very important places will pop up in our discussion, we will not be giving them detailed attention unless they fall under the borders of the state of Tabasco. To that end, we would do best to follow the lives and accomplishments of the Chontal tribe, often referred to as the Chontal Maya. What I intended to do was one episode going over the tribes, and then moving on to the history. Alas, each tribe has such rich history, traditions, and mythology that I have decided to give each of them their own dedicated episode. That being said, I am not a professional linguist or member of any of these native tribes, so my apologies in advance to anyone who is that may find my pronunciation subpar. I will constantly be doing my best to show all these people and languages the dignity and respect they deserve, but please email if you have any corrections, comments, or questions to thehistoriesofmexico@gmail.com. Given that this episode's discussion is on the historical side of things, I do wish to add a site to the list of things to see in Tabasco that I missed in the previous episode. Thanks to an inclusion by a very close friend of mine, you may add the Museo de Historia de Tabasco, or the Tabasco History Museum, located in Villahermosa, to the travel list. Also known as the Casa de los Azulejos, with azulejos meaning tiles in Spanish, this museum is relatively small, takes about an hour to cover, costs about $1.50, and unfortunately only has signage in Spanish. Regardless of your grasp on the language, this was brought to my attention for the building itself, having imported hundreds of Spanish tiles to adorn its beautiful rooms and exterior. You will also get to see many items and displays associated with the events we will be covering in the coming episodes, so do give it a visit when you get the chance to go to Villahermosa. But now, let's move on with the show. In this series on Tabasco, we will rely heavily on the work done by native Tabascan Dr. Diogenes Lopez Reyes, who wrote his historical dedication to his beloved state throughout 16 years of his long life, finally completing his magnum opus weeks before his death in 1964. Officially given recognition and validity by the Tabascan government in the same year, his extensive writings on the subject matter we are discussing have proven indispensable in researching the state, and so I must take a moment to give an enormous credit to all the work and love contributed by Dr. Reyes. Now, beginning a discussion of the tribes in earnest, it would serve us well to first identify them. There are several ethnic tribes that still inhabit the lands of Tabasco. They include the Chontal, the Nahuas, the Zoques, the Choles, the Tzetzals, and the Ayapanecos. The Choles, Zoques, and Tzetzals actually have the bulk of their populations and history in Chiapas. But since Chiapas has an insane amount of tribes to talk about, I decided to give them an episode during this run. However, they were not always present in Tabasco during the prehistoric times, and over the years either got pushed out, decided to flee an encroaching enemy, or fell under new borders due to the socio-political shiftings of the revolutionary periods. The Nahua, meanwhile, have their homes further to the west and must be covered in another episode more focused on their origins and cultural characteristics. They are nonetheless a massively important feature in the overall history of Mesoamerica, almost as much as the Maya and Aztecs. Let's not forget, the language of the Aztec Empire was Nahuatl, given that the Mexican people who comprised the ruling class of the Aztec Empire were of Nahua ethnicity, so do remember the name, the Nahua. There are also tribes we will speak about that have precious little evidence of their existence, rendering the stories and accounts about them more mythological than historical. For example, the earliest settlers and first in our discussions, the Mo or the Yomo, who were all but extinguished by the time the Chontal and other Mayan people arrived in their land. Another example is the legendary Votanides, or followers of Votan, who would have been contemporaries of the Chontal and are most likely the modern-day Tzetzals, given mythological origins by imaginative academics in the 1900s. Sadly, we will not have time to discuss the Votanides at this time, and they and their mythical origins will have to patiently await their full introduction in a few episodes. And so we begin with our first inhabitants of the land of Tabasco, who, according to our illustrious guide, Dr. Diogenes Lopez Reyes, were the descendants of the Mo or Yomo. It is said they sprang like fruits from a giant ceiba tree, which was sacred to the Mo and nearly every tribe that encountered the striking plants. This reverence to the ceiba would extend to their politics, as members of the elder council would meet underneath the shade of the great tree to decide on laws, plan religious events, and administer justice. The Mo would typically build their villages around a particularly large ceiba, while adorning the roots of their sacred tree with offerings of sweet resins, tropical bird feathers, and various fruits and flowers. Their villages and homes were primitive, made of natural materials such as palm leaves, wood, and mud, located along the beaches and banks of rivers and lagoons, with the typical ceiba located at its center. Interestingly to me is this bit of reverse hunter-gatherer dynamic, in that the living placements for the nomadic hunter tribes were dictated by the movements of animals, whereas here, the locations of the villages of the Mo would appear to be dictated by the movements of trees. Likewise, the Aztecs would center their great capital of Tenochtitlan at the site of a growing cactus with an eagle atop it eating a snake. So it seems the trend of vegetation dictating city placement did not end with the Mo. Now, it would appear that the Mo's reverence to the ceiba did not just come from the aesthetic nature of the tree or the imagination of the Indian. During the typical Tabascan floods that we now know are constant in the region, the ancient Mo were said to have climbed their sacred trees turned saviors to escape the floodwaters and hungry animals that were frequent visitors to the relatively undefended Mo villages. In contrast to the mighty indigenous metropolises we are soon to encounter, the Mo lived relatively quiet lives of farming, hunting, and fishing, until they were attacked and displaced, according to Dr. Reyes, around 400 BCE, by a much more warlike people, the Chontal. Unfortunately for us, the Mo built their structures and altars primarily out of natural materials, so there are none left over to attest to their existence. The few accounts we have about them come from the stories passed down through the generations of the Chontal who would come to displace them in 400 BCE. After our discussions in episode 2, however, there should be little doubt that there were indeed people living in this area, much like the Mo, and so their existence, although hard to validate, is still plausible as our first true inhabitants of the region. Now, if we were to follow the timeline exactly, this is the point at which we would begin discussing the Olmecs, for they have had evidence of their existence long before the Chontal showed up to the party. This, unfortunately, will have to wait until we finish with Tabasco, as there is a lot to discuss when it comes to the Olmecs. However, in an effort to keep the timeline straight, let's discuss them briefly. It is believed that the first Olmec site, San Lorenzo, located in Veracruz, was established around 1200 BCE. Although signs of pre-Olmec cultures are scattered throughout this Gulf region and can be seen as early as 16,000 BCE, so that is where we will place our official beginning of the Olmecs. San Lorenzo would stand for about 300 years until 900 BCE, when it was destroyed and its monuments defaced, forcing the ruling class to move the Olmec capital to a new site further to the east called La Venta, located on a tributary of the Grijalva River in the modern-day Chontalpa region of Tabasco, that western part that borders Veracruz. La Venta would become the jewel of the Olmec civilization, and would trade and spread its influence for 500 long and glorious years, until it too went the way of San Lorenzo, with the complete destruction of the city and defacement of its monuments in 400 BCE. The cause of these two cities' decline is unknown and likely unknowable, as there were very few written records kept at the time, and none would have been erected after the fall of either cities. The likeliest explanation in my mind out of the many proposed is social unrest due to the Olmec's cultural practices coupled with a string of bad harvests setting up the perfect conditions for a massive peasant revolt. The various theories will be explored in the Olmecs episode, but by 300 BCE, the Olmecs are all but gone. Yet a new tribe was waiting in the wings to take up the Olmec mantle, and these would be the Chontal, which again arrived in Tabasco in 400 BCE, around the same time La Venta was destroyed. Somewhere in here, there may be a connection between the Olmecs who fled San Lorenzo in 900 BCE to start La Venta, the Olmecs who fled La Venta in 400 BCE, and the Chontal who appeared on the scene around the same year. The Olmecs had already fled to the east once and established a new city, and there are theories floating out there that they did the same in this case. We will explore these theories later, but do note during these early periods the seemingly unceasing movement of these and other tribes during all of the troubles that they faced. As I have said, the modern Chontal have the biggest presence in the state and are currently concentrated in the municipalities of Jalpa de Mendez, Cunduacan, and Nacajuca, which I incorrectly pronounced as Nacajuac last episode. My very embarrassing mistake. In Nacajuca, one can visit Chontal villages where the language and culture are still spoken and practiced. Places such as Tucta, Mazateupa, Oxiacaque, Tecoluta, and Guatacalca, all found in the Nacajuca municipality. The ancient kingdom of the Chontal, on the other hand, was known as the Kingdom of Chocotitlan, although it went by a number of other names in the various languages of the region. At its heights, it extended further than the center of Tabasco, with populations stretching to the east into Campeche, the southern Yucatan, northern Guatemala and Belize, and southern Quintana Roo, a state on the eastern coast of the Yucatan Peninsula. The word Chontal originally comes from the Nahua word meaning foreigner, alien, or outsider, which the later Mexica of Aztec fame would translate to Chontali. Meanwhile, the Maya would label them Chocos, meaning children or descendants of the Puma. The Nahua in particular chose to label anyone not from their lands a Chontal, much like the Romans considered anyone outside of Roman lands a barbarian. This made it much easier to dehumanize the enemy, and warriors found it much easier to pillage and kill anyone who they did not consider one of their own. However, a great deal of mixing would occur between the Maya, Nahua, and other tribes that eventually would make it very hard to distinguish an exclusively Chontal tribe to a Nahua one. The distinguishing features would then become the alliances made between cities. The Chontal of modern Tabasco, meanwhile, call themselves the Yocotano, meaning the speakers of Yoko o Choco, or the true speech, the name they have given to their language. And some Yoko Yinikob, or true men, and Yoko Ishikob, or true women, consider themselves descendants of the Olmecs. This connection is unclear, as we have stated, and while they do inhabit the lands close to those of the Olmecs, the stronger lingual connections to the Maya leaves the question still up in the air. Did the early Chontal come from Mayan ancestry and establish a new Olmec culture? Or did they come from Olmec ancestry and adopt a Mayan language? Did the Olmecs fleeing the destruction of La Venta mix and mingle with the ancient Mo and migrating Mayans to establish a new ethnicity altogether? As always, the truth is likely somewhere in the middle. Furthermore, it seems possible that the Chontals might have actually predated the Olmecs, as we will discuss in a bit. Sadly, we may never know the real answer, but I have no doubt that these kinds of questions are the cause of many an anthropologist's sleepless nights. The Chontal would establish themselves smack between the Maya to the east in the Yucatan, the riverways that connected the Gulf Coast to the Pacific Ocean far to the south through Chiapas and Oaxaca, and the Nahua-speaking civilizations that would rise and fall in the central Mexican valley to the west, the Mexica being the most notable, but certainly not the only ones. Such a location would afford the Chontal a rich trading network, not unlike those established by the Olmecs who preceded them, connecting the markets of the eastern, western, and southern Mesoamerican world in one central and easily accessible location, thanks to the many rivers that flow through the land, such as the Grijalva and Usumacinta, which we have covered in the previous episode. Consequently, this would also put them in the path of any would-be conquering tribes that attempted to subjugate the lands beyond theirs. On multiple occasions, tribes from both the east and west conquered their way through Chontal territory, bending the knee of the mighty tribe and leaving behind garrisons in order to collect tribute. According to Dr. Diogenes Lopez Reyes, it is said that the mysterious ancestors of the Chontal migrated from Indonesia into Peru through the Pacific Coastal Corridor we discussed in Episode 2. These early settlers then moved northwards along the Peruvian coast through Colombia, establishing themselves for a long time in modern-day Nicaragua, Honduras, and El Salvador, the theorized birthplace of the Mayan people as we know them. we can still find enough genetic links between the Chontal people living in Tabasco and the natives who still reside in Central America to give credence to the theory that the Chontal and other Mayan ethnicities originated there before spreading out north into the lands we typically associate with them today. Eventually, these early Mayan people living in Central America would take to the Atlantic Ocean and land all across Quintana Roo's shores, with our particular tribe of people landing near the site of Pole in the early formative, around 1000 BCE, according to Dr. Reyes. The site of Pole is one we will discuss more when we get to the state of Quintana Roo, whose most famous features are easily the cities of Cancun, Tulum, and the Riviera Maya, along which lies the site of Pole. The various landings of the Mayan people on these shores will also take up a portion of our discussion then. For now, we will focus on one in particular, the Putunes. This landing in Pole in 1000 BCE would not prove the salvation of the Putunes, as the inadequate soil for their crops and hostile pre-Mayan natives would force our merry band to keep moving west until finally arriving at the location most associated with them, Tabasco. Now, according to the Yucatano, they are indeed the Mayan ethnicity called Putunes. And yes, this does seemingly conflict with their Olmec origin claims, which highlights the unreliability of oral accounts for history. Now, the statement could just mean that they are physical descendants of the Maya and merely spiritual descendants of the Olmecs, but it is really hard to tell what the Yucatano mean when they claim that they are descended from both. Nevertheless, these Putunes would leave behind their Mayan peninsular cousins, earning their name of Chocos, and settling in the lands of western and central Tabasco, along with parts of Campeche, located near the Laguna de Terminos, which is fed by various tributaries of the Usumacinta. By the by, Laguna de Terminos means the Lagoon of Termination, as many rivers deposit their waters into this enormous lagoon/lake. As we will see with our exploration of the Chontal, these migrations were not unidirectional, and these Mayan ethnicities, such as the one the Chontals belong to, the Putunes, would have various periods of migrations, mainly due to encroaching tribes or flat-out conquest by another power or cities. This would predictably cause the survivors to flee and set up somewhere else, sometimes leading to a new ethnicity being developed or the same ethnicity eventually returning to the lands they left behind, an occurrence which supposedly happened to a branch of the Chontal. But what are these Putunes? Well, Putunes is a classification of Mayan ethnicity, and these ethnicities will be very important in our approaching discussions of the Mayan world. There are a large variety of these ethnicities, all running around, settling, allying, trading, and warring amongst each other, and they each have their own history, cultural achievements, and provinces they established, which are now known as Casisazgos, but back then were called Cuchcabals. These Putunes were fantastic seafarers, evidenced by their arrival on Yucatan shores by boat rather than by foot. They would come to master not only the riverways that surrounded their lands, but also the Gulf of Mexico they would come to explore and trade along. The book Maya History and Religion puts it best by claiming the Putunes were the Phoenicians of the New World. And as we will see, this comparison is both flattering and apt. Again, do not be intimidated. I will do everything I can to keep reminding you of all the important places and names we need to keep track of, so do not worry. While I will mention other Mayan ethnicities in this episode, for now just remember the name of the Putunes, as we follow them around for a bit and see what hijinks they get into. Dr. Diogenes claims that shortly after establishing themselves in Tabasco, the warlike and conquest-hungry Choco people would take three migratory routes in search of further glory, leaving behind their Yucatan brothers and sisters in Tabasco to forge new colonies, expand the Chontal power, and grow rich in the process. In an incredible historical twist that almost feels scripted, it would be the same Choco people centuries later who would be the first to encounter the warlike and conquest-hungry Spanish people searching for further glory, who had left behind their Spanish brothers and sisters in Spain to forge new colonies, expand Spanish power, and grow rich in the process. History, it seems, has a deep appreciation for human irony. The first of these migratory groups would expedition into the mountains of Chiapas and Oaxaca, seeking to extend their borders closer to their sought-after markets in the Pacific coast. This southern group would eventually be surrounded by the expanding Zapoteco and Mixteco tribes that moved into the region during the years of 1200 to 800 BCE, smack in the middle of the pre-classical. The Zapoteco and Mixteco numerical advantage would push the wayward Chocos further south and away from their ethnic relatives. These Chocos would continue spreading west into modern-day Guerrero, Michoacán, and all the way into Jalisco. They eventually became known as the Oaxacan Chontal, a completely separate ethnic group from their once close to Basque brethren that still share a similar language, but after many years have since drifted apart in both culture and religion. It is said that the Aztec Emperor Cuauhtémoc's matrial lineage is descended from this southern Choco branch, which we will revisit very soon, as our next state episode will likely be all about Oaxaca. A second migratory group is stated by Dr. Reyes to have pushed into the west, and he suggests that they may have begun the Olmec culture we have heard so much about. This theory lacks substantial hard evidence, and for now lives in the realm of conjecture. But it would explain how the Olmecs established such a vast trade empire so quickly after a relatively short time on the historical scene. It would also go a long way towards explaining the relative lack of armed conflict between the Olmecs and their western neighbors in the Tabascan neighborhood during the rise to prominence that they had, and gives credence to the idea that when La Venta fell in 400 BCE, the Olmecs would have likely fled to their ancestral home with the Chocos. But again, there is no way to know for sure, and Dr. Reyes is one of the few sources to mention the connection happening before the fall of La Venta, so there is not much we can do to support or defend it. The final group directed its migration northwards along the Gulf Coast into Veracruz, past Tamaulipas, and eventually all the way to the mouth of the Mississippi River. Not much is known about this third group, but we can imagine that they too went on to establish a culture that mixed and mingled with whatever other native peoples populated the region at the time, likely the descendants of the Clovis people of Episode 2 fame. There is an obscure account given by a Spanish explorer in Florida that could clue us in to the movements of this branch of northern Chocos. Hernando de Soto would land in Tampa Bay, Florida in 1539, only to immediately demand to be taken to where the gold was kept. The locals would point him in the direction of a town called Ocale, which sat in a province called Ucueten. Now here is where things get interesting, as the following town his band of conquistadors encountered was called Potano. Here, I should mention how the Putunes confusingly like to go by both Putun and Poton. Likewise, Ucuten, when placed next to Yocotan, does bear some similarities if you're squinting your ears. Ocale, however, does not seem to fit, until we learn about another passage in the book Maya History and Religion concerning the Putuns. Quote, "The Putun established themselves, naming their land Acala or Acalan, land of the canoe people." End quote. And now Ocale and Acala seem a whole lot more similar. If we are to believe what we have just heard, and the Putunes were indeed also called Potones, and were also the Phoenician-esque seamasters the sources claim they were, then there seems little doubt these Ocale people are the third migratory group still running a successful trade empire based on the accounts given to De Soto about their possession of vast quantities of gold. Another account of De Soto, this time found in a letter he sent to the King of Spain, told of the foods he witnessed the people eating. They would eat turkey, deer, and small dogs that didn't bark. Now, all three of these would have also been accessible to the Maya of Tabasco, and thus we have further evidence to the connection between these two tribes. Not only did they have similar names, they ate similar foods. De Soto never did find the city of Ocale. Likely, his guides feared what would happen to them at the hands of the Potons if they ever brought this violent and rowdy group of foreigners to the doors of their great city. Instead, they pointed them north towards better towns with more gold, and with their fingers crossed behind their backs, they likely hoped that Hernando would take the bait, which he happily did. Later in that century, in 1564, the French would explore the same area and come into contact with a tribe they called the Boutanou, operating a massive gold operation outside of the Appalachian Mountains in Georgia, and transporting it via the Mississippi River to the Atlantic Ocean and on into markets along the Mexican and Yucatan coasts, the islands of the Caribbean, and reaching as far as the jungles of Honduras. Had De Soto ever reached the great city of Ocale, likely located near modern-day city of Atlanta, he would have been sorely disappointed at the lack of gold artifacts, since it seems clear from the French explorer's account that this gold was meant exclusively for the export market. It would appear that the Potanu of Georgia were shipping the gold to the Potano of Ocale, to then be sent off into the wider markets. Another account by the Spanish mentioned a tribe called the Mayaca living in the southern end of Lake George, with a shipwrecked Spaniard named Fontenada reporting yet another with the name Mayahuaca near Cape Canaveral. A third was described as the Mayaimi near Lake Okeechobee, which is located too close to the city of Miami to not make a reasonable connection between the two. It seems that with the mastery the Putunes have clearly displayed, that we can easily imagine the activities of the third migratory group Dr. Diogenes mentions. Upon reaching the mouth of the Mississippi, they undoubtedly did what they did best and navigated up the river until they reached a suitable place to establish their great city of Ocale, setting up a highly successful trade route in the process. While the migratory groups would meet with mixed results, the Chocos that stayed behind and populated the Tabasco region would become the Yocotanob and come to establish Cuchcabals or Cachazgos, the Mayan equivalent of kingdoms or provinces, in three notable locations. One in the confluence of the Grijalva and Usumacinta, the region known as Los Pantanos, if you remember our geography episode. Another in the areas around the Laguna de Terminos in Campeche, just north and east of Los Pantanos. And the third being the region that makes up parts of modern-day Belize and Guatemala on the southern eastern coast of the Yucatan Peninsula, an area just south of the modern-day town of Bacalar in Quintana Roo. These are considered Putun territories to us modern scholars, but to the Mayans back then, these would have been considered Choco territories and part of the Cachazgos of Chocotan, land of the descendants of the Puma. Individually, however, these three regions were practically their own political entities by the time the Spanish arrived. The area in Tabasco we are most familiar with was known by the Mayans as Potonchan, whose name will be explained in a moment. The territories of the Campechan branch of the Yocotanob was known as Chacan Putum, with the capital at Isamacanac, on the outskirts of the Laguna de Terminos. Finally, the third Belizean/Guatemalan Cuchcabal was called Chactemal, located closest to the modern-day city of Chetumal in southern Quintana Roo. Before we talk about the Tabascan kingdom in detail, there is an interesting story told to us by our illustrious guide, which highlights both the ever-shifting borders of the Mayan world and the potential for migration in both directions that all tribes could take. We are told by Dr. Diogenes that in the year 320 CE, the Putun Mayans who lived in Tabasco were invaded by a neighboring force, and a group of them fled towards Guatemala, an area which back then was known as Petén. After living there for a time, they decided to move again, this time under the leadership of one Holonchan, and traveled east towards the coast, eventually establishing the city of Sian Ka'an Bakalal in 435 CE, now known as the modern Pueblo Mágico of Bacalar in southern Quintana Roo. Upon arriving, they would take the name of Chanes after their leader who had led them to salvation, Jolon Chan. They would stay here for just over 60 years before deciding to migrate again in 555 CE, this time into the interior of the peninsula, taking a northward route until reaching and founding the sites of Chichen Itza, effectively becoming the Mayan ethnicity known as the Itzas. These Itzas would then go on to establish Izamal, To, or modern-day capital of the state of Yucatan, Mérida, and come back into Chacan-Putum, where they would last until 928 CE, according to the book of Chilam Balam de Chumayel, one of the few surviving accounts written by the Mayans about their own history. It is around this time when they would be displaced from Chacan-Putum by another rising Mayan ethnicity called the Tutul-Xihues, known as those who brim with virtue. This is quite a lot of movement, and in all directions, it would seem, and gives a good idea of the amount of travel some of these tribes would participate in order to eke out a successful existence. Unfortunately, we cannot take these events as historical fact due to the lack of empirical evidence to support the grand claim that the Itzas people were once the Putunes people. Many scholars believe this to be the case, and the theories are supported by documents such as the Chilam Balam de Chumayel. The only issue is that the Chilam Balam also has mythological stories told side by side with historical accounts, so there is no way to know what is true and what is myth, similar to Chontal claims of both Mayan and Olmec descendancy. While this may all just be an embellished story of the real events that took place, it does paint a pretty realistic situation faced by the many tribes that lived in Yucatan at this time. Migrations such as those of the Oaxacan Chontal, who can trace back their direct path through their own histories, and the northern Potons give credence to the constant movement of these early tribes and people during the pre-Hispanic periods of Mesoamerican history. So, we know the ethnic Mayans were doing their migration thing during the preclassical, and by 400 BCE had begun claiming their Tabascan homeland. However, by the time of the classical period, which started around 250 CE, other Mayan centers would also be erected. Sites such as Comalcalco, Santa Elena, Aguada Fénix, and Moral Reforma would begin showing numerous signs of activity and construction. However, they would all be abandoned by the 800 and 900 CEs during the mysterious Mayan collapse, also considered the end of the classical period and beginning of the post-classical, which would last until the arrival of the Spanish in 1519. We will not be discussing many events of this classical period, rather saving a discussion of the classical Tabascan sites for the episode on the Votanides / Tzetzals, who were most active during this time. There, we will also go over the history and activities of the archaeological sites present during this time, but for now, we will continue with our narrative following the Chocos, and circle back to Comalcalco and other Mayan sites in a few episodes. The Chocos of Tabasco, on the other hand, would live relatively undisturbed in their capital of Potonchan for around 1,000 years, until about 400 CE, when a migration of the Nahua people began coming from the central Mexican valley, likely the refugees from the decline of another city called Teotihuacan, or Place Where the Gods Are Born, which completed its decline around 550 CE. Teotihuacan would prove a very influential city to the people of the central Mexican valley, and the name may sound familiar as it is the single most visited site in Mexico. There will be much more to be said about Teotihuacan and its history, but for now, all we need to know is that it did indeed fall around 550 CE, displacing its people and ruling class, and likely triggered a massive Nahua migration to the east and into the Yucatan Peninsula. These Nahua-speaking people would establish three provinces in the Chontal region, which would constantly war and clash with the native Chocos. These were called Ahualulco, which was located on the banks of the Tonal River on the border between Tabasco and Veracruz to the west, Cimatán, which was located between Comalcalco and modern-day Villahermosa, comprised mainly of the Cunduacan municipality, and the third was in Xicalango, found on the banks of the Laguna de Términos, located in Campeche to the east of Potonchan. These tribes would jostle for dominion for centuries with the Nahuatl tribes, eventually edging out the Chontal in influence thanks to the rise of the Aztec Empire in the 15th century, who supported their Nahuatl cousins in their expansionary endeavors. This is the reason for so many Tabascan place names being in Nahua rather than Mayan or Chontal, since the Nahua are who were ultimately in charge when the Spanish arrived. A perfect example is the archaeological site of Comalcalco, which is actually the Mayan city of Joychan. However, we still know it to this day by its Nahuatl name of Comalcalco. The Chontal capital was originally named Chocotitlan. However, it would come to be called the more derogatory Potonchan, which according to Dr. Diogenes Lopez Reyes in the Mayan language means something like hideous, damnable, or stinky snake. No love lost, it seems, between the Chontal and Yucatan Maya. But this name-calling is very indicative of how the relationship appeared from the Mayan point of view. The Chontal were considered outsiders and dangerous. They represented nothing less than a challenge to the resources and powers of the local authorities, and they were not welcome. These kinds of sentiments would become a fixture in the complex relationships between the many tribes that were to come, but the Chontal would have the undesirable distinction of lugging their unwelcome status along with their very name through the ages. In the wake of the Mayan collapse between 800 and 900 CE, the Mexica and Nahua people from central Mexico would complete their takeover of the surrounding lands and bestow the Yucatanob with the name of Chontales, which we have already mentioned they translated to foreigner, immediately alienating and dismissing any Choco territorial claims. This name would have applied to all the Mayan peoples living beyond the Chontal lands. However, since they were on the frontier with the central Mexican tribes, they got the privilege of being stuck with the name when the Spanish arrived, thus keeping it into the present. The fact that they are still called Chontal to this very day is a sad testament to the effective negative PR efforts by ancient xenophobic Aztecs. All this being said, if you do find yourself in Tabasco, near Nacajuca territory, and want to score points with the locals, be sure to refer to them as the Yucatanob or the Yucatan people, rather than Chontal. You wouldn't like it if someone came to your hometown and started calling you a foreigner, now would you? For simplicity's sake, however, we must continue using the Chontal and Potonchan designations, since most of the sources will utilize these names rather than the lingually cumbersome Yucatanob or Chocotitlan, so they still serve us in an academic sense. But it is important to know the true names of tribes as they view themselves, in order to show them the respect and dignity they deserve. Likewise, knowing the meaning of names or places can give us another layer of understanding when exploring these locations and lands, as we will see when we discuss the origin of the name of Tabasco. The Chontal would thus go through various spells of dominion and independence with the Nahua. However, after the Mayan collapse of 800 and 900 CE, the Chontal would fall completely under Nahua rule, at which point the capital of Chocotitlan would earn its third name, the Nahua given Nonoalco. Nonoalco / Potonchan / Chocotitlan would be situated at a strategic location along the river lanes, and after the Nahua and Mexica tribes conquered the area, they selected a Lord of Potonchan from their warriors, who would rule over the eight surrounding provinces. These provinces were called the Eight Little Lions, likely another allusion to pumas, as lion and puma to the Mexican tribes meant about the same thing. And these little lions were ruled over by governors known as co, or caciques, which literally translates to puma or lion. The Cos, or Lions, were aided in the administration of their province by a council of elders who maintained order, customs, and administered justice. These councils would always meet under the shade of a ceiba tree, another example of the Ceiba's sacred status among the Chontal, and an echo of their precursors, the Mo. Each province was responsible for sending the necessary tribute of men and treasure to the central capital in Potonchan. The tribute would be sent to the Supreme Ko, head of the Eight Lions, and thus the Halak Uinik, or Mayan religious and political leader, was known as the Lord of the Nine Pumas, and was referred to as the Strong Father Lion, which can be translated as the Ta-Ba-Ko, or Tab-Wahak-Ko. Now, what a revelation this was to me. If you go online and ask Google what the origin of the name of the state of Tabasco is, it will tell you that there was a Chontal chief named Tabs-Kub, who had a river named after him, and that's how we get the name. But here we see a slightly different explanation, for in fact, all the chiefs of the Chontal were Tabacos, for this was the land of the Tabaco, ruler of Potonchan. To me, this was very illuminating, and went to show me how the truth of these tribes is out there, but possibly skewed or misinterpreted, lacking details that really tell the story properly. And so I share with you this, my most proud discovery to date, about the origin of the name of the state I have been reading oh so much about. Other theories do exist on the name, however, with one suggesting the name is related to the Mayan word Tlapalco, which translates to the place of damp earth, while another brings up the possibility of the Nahuatl word for Tlapachli, meaning place that has an owner, as being the true origin. However, the fact that Dr. Diogenes does not mention any of these other theories leads this humble history fan to believe that the true origin is this translation of Ta-Ba-Ko as the strong father lion. Thus, the lands of the Ta-Ba-Ko comprised of the following eight little lions. Potonchan was the capital, comprising modern-day municipalities of Centro, Centla, parts of Jonuta, Macuspana, and extending into parts of the Campechan Islands of Carmen along the coast of the Gulf of Mexico. Cupilcom was to the west and made up of Jalpa de Méndez, Comalcalco, Paraíso, parts of Cárdenas and Humanguillo, and a chunk of Chiapas known as Pichucalco. This area is also where the Choles and Zoques are most active. Chilapan comprised mostly of Macuspana, while Iztapa made up the municipalities of Emiliano Zapata, Balancán, and Tenosique to the southeast. Nacajujuca would be shortened to Nacajuca and currently sits in the same location as it did back then. Xalapa Zaguatán would drop the Zaguatán to just become Xalapa. Meanwhile, Tacotalpa and Tiapa have both retained their original names throughout the ages. Let's also not forget the Nahuatl provinces that were living side by side with these little lions. Those of Ahualulco to the west, Simatán in Cunduacán, and Xicalango on the banks of the Laguna de Términos in Campeche. There were also a number of other Mayan cities that existed in this region, such as Comalcalco, but we will save Comalcalco for next episode, as their epic clash with Tortuguero, another Mayan city operating in Tabascan lands, will be better told on the episode discussing the Tetzals. And thus, this would be the composition of the Chontal kingdom shortly after the Mayan collapse, and likely until the Spanish arrival. The little lions or pumas and their co-rulers would be expected to send yearly tribute to Potonchan, and occasionally warriors for military campaigns. One of the best examples of the military tribute sent from the Kos to the Tabaco can be seen in 948 CE, when the Chontal marched out in force with an army of allied Mayans under the leadership of one Ahmecat Tutulxihue, from whom the Tutulxihue Mayas, those who are brimming with virtue, would get their name, much like the Chanes were named after their leader, Jolonchan. This leader, Ahmecat, also went by the nickname Hun Huitzil Chac, or the single mountain of Chac. Chac was a very important rain and storm god to the Maya, and we will see a reoccurring theme of Mayan leaders styling themselves as avatars or prophets of this and other great deities in order to legitimize their claims to power. Having gathered all the Chontal warriors from the Eight Little Lions, together with the Tutul Shiwes, they marched into the region of Chaconputum, which at the time was populated by the Itzas Mayas, pushing them out and down into Petén, Guatemala, to the south. The Tutul Shiwes would thus establish themselves in Uxmal and Mani, while the Chontal would gain control of Chaconputum, extending their territory into the Yucatan Peninsula. Ahmecat would then lead Uxmal into an alliance with Chichen Itza, Mayapan, Ixmal, Tulum, Ixpatun, and other Mayan cities to form the League or Confederation of Mayapan, a quasi-legendary coalition that existed between the major city-states of the Yucatan Peninsula, and one we must leave the deeper discussion of for another episode. What is important for our story is that this alliance eventually broke down, and a war would be declared between two of its most prominent members, Mayapan and Chichen Itza. According to the Chilam Balam de Chumayel, sometime in 1185 CE, a notable leader rose to power in Mayapan named Hunac Sel Cahuich, who was thrown as a sacrificial offering into the sacred cenote of Chichen Itza by Itza leader Amex Cuc after Hunac Sel unsuccessfully fought in a battle against the Itza and became their prisoner. In case you didn't already know, a cenote is a natural pit or sinkhole that results from the collapse of limestone that exposes groundwater, and there are numerous in the land surrounding the Gulf of Mexico. These cenotes were highly revered and would come to play an enormous role in the Mayan religious beliefs, much like the Ceiba did to the Chontal and Mo before them. Hunac Sel, meanwhile, would miraculously survive both the fall and a full night wading in the water, finally being discovered the next day by some very surprised and likely bewildered priests. This was not supposed to happen, and things got more mysterious when, upon being pulled out and emerging from the pit, the offering began to speak of a prophecy he had received from the rain god Chalk while waiting in the sacred cenote, regarding the coming year's harvest. He likewise made claims that he was the adopted son of Amex Cuc, the Itza leader, that his mother had been an eagle, and that he was born and discovered in the mountains as a child. Unsurprisingly, the superstitious Itza would believe these divine portents, and surprisingly, would support their once prisoner, Hunac Sel, for the seat of Mayapan rule. Perhaps they did so with the intention of pleasing Chalk and bringing a bountiful harvest. Maybe the Itza believed that by sparing his life, Hunac Sel would forgive them for having endangered it in the first place and become a loyal ally to Chichen Itza. And for a while, it would work, with the two powers exchanging gifts and existing in peace for a number of years. However, it would not take long for the cracks to show, and the pleasantries would soon break down in 1194, when the two city-states would declare war on each other. However, the cause of the initial hostilities is still highly debated. As always, there is a mythological explanation and the more sober reality painted by the archaeological record and anthropological research. The mythological explanation sounds like a screenwriter's movie fantasy of crafting the Trojan War set in the Mayan Yucatan. The story of the Trojan War is that the Trojan prince Paris stole Helen, the wife of the Spartan king Menelaus, which prompted the Spartan king's brother, a man named Agamemnon, and king of Mycenae, to call his Greek banners and declare war on Troy for the honor of Sparta. The Mayan version goes that a Chichen Itza warrior stole the wife of Ixmal king Ahulil, which prompted the Ixmal king's ally, a man named Hunac Sel, and king of Mayapan, to call his Mayan banners and declare war on Chichen Itza for the honor of Ixmal. Hunac, likely relishing the opportunity for revenge on those who once chucked him into a pit to die. This version of the story, though undoubtedly epic if true, is likely not the case. What is more likely is a bit more complex than we have time to get into in this episode, but it won't do anyone any good to get into any cliffhangers, so I'll explain it the best I can without going down the Mayan rabbit hole. The more plausible explanation goes that between the 10th and 11th century CE, another wave of migration from the western tribes of the central Mexican Valley would enter on the scene, much like the Tetihuacanos had in the 5th and 6th centuries CE. These would be led primarily by the remnants of the royal family of the Toltec people. The Toltecs were located in the city of Tula, in the modern-day state of Hidalgo. However, their civilization crumbled either due to climate change, conquest, civil unrest, or a happy combination of all three, and you can hopefully begin to see a trend in indigenous peoples' migrations. The Toltec ruling class and the survivors that managed to escape their city's calamitous end would move west into the lands of the Yucatan and began establishing provinces and cities in the Mayan lands. They would bring with them their language, their art, and their gods, most notably their cult of the feathered serpent Quetzalcoatl, who the Mayans would adopt as Kukulcan. His would be one of the most influential cults to take hold of the Mayan imagination and inspire some of the most impressive architectural constructions of the Mayan world. The Chontals too would have a name for the feathered serpent. They would call him Muculechan. It is believed these Toltec people arrived and revitalized Chichen Itza, and it is during this phase of construction that the main architectural features of the great city were likely erected that still stand today. Further evidence to this fact is the architectural and stylistic similarities seen between the buildings found in the abandoned city of Tula and those of Chichen Itza. The Toltec people living in Chichen Itza were thus viewed as outsiders by the Mayan people, and rather than live alongside them, they opted to attack and push these new Itzas out of their newly refurbished city and back into the jungles of uncertainty. It is said these fleeing Itza Toltecs would establish a new city of Nojopeten in Guatemala, and this would be the last Mayan stronghold to hold out against the Spanish, resisting for over 150 years until they were finally conquered by Martin de Ursua in 1697. But that won't come for a while on our show, so for now, let's focus back on Tabasco. Tying everything back to the Chontal, they would be among the banners called by Hunaxel to fight in the wars between Mayapan and Chichen Itza, and would be present when the mighty city of Chichen Itza, much like the legendary city of Troy, would fall and be burned to the ground. Although the Chontal greatly contributed to the victory, the generals of each co were even recorded by Mayapan in the subsequent victory stela, the rewards this time around would not amount to territory won, as was the case when they assisted Akhmecat and his Tutulxihues, and instead the Chontal would merely fall under the Mayapan hegemony that ruled following the destruction of Chichen Itza and the capture of its lord, one Chaksib Chak, a member of the prestigious Chan dynasty, according to Dr. Diogenes. This political landscape would once again be shaken up with another outbreak of war, this time between the Mayans of Mayapan, now known as Cocomes, and the Tutulxihues of Uxmal and their new capital of Mani, in a war that is said to have lasted from 1228 CE to 1440 CE. Just to give the story a conclusion, the final score would be set when Axupanxiu, leader of the Tutulxihues and descendant of the legendary Akhmecat, he of the singular mountain of Chak, managed to defeat the Cocomes, destroyed Mayapan, and executed the entire Cocom royal family in 1441 CE. Only one member of the royal family survived the slaughter and fled to Honduras, eventually returning to establish the city of Tibolon and the Cuchcabal of Sotuta, just northwest of Mayapan. It is at this point that the Mayan world would hold its shape, relatively unchanged, until the Spanish arrived to begin their happy conquering of just about everything in 1519. By this point, the 16 or 17 Cuchcabals or Cachazgos of the Yucatan would be finalized and poised for their meeting with their Spanish conquistadors in the 1520s and 30s. And it is also here that we will finish our episode, as it has already gone long enough. Next episode, we will shift gears a bit and go into a discussion of the Choco people themselves, as conveyed by Dr. Diogenes, and hear a bit of their music as we describe their religious rituals and danzas, which are still practiced to this day. At the end, we will tell one last story about the Chontal that will set the stage nicely for the next historical entry, where they will finally encounter the Spanish-speaking destiny all Mexican tribes will soon have to face. Before I go, I would like to apologize for the time it took in releasing this episode. Not only did I have to actually have a life, but the sheer amount of information I am having to parse through and organize in a presentable manner has proven harder than anyone could have anticipated. However, I am undaunted, and I'm hoping to release the next episode very shortly, and then get back into something of a 9 to 10 day cycle of releasing episodes. Since I started this podcast a whole of 2 months ago, I have also seen a steady increase in listeners, and I would like to better engage with you all, so I am committing myself to having a Facebook page up by the next episode, as it would seem only the elderly and spammers use emails nowadays, so I will activate the socials in order to reach my clearly young and good-looking audience. If you are enjoying the show, please do not hesitate to recommend it to a friend, coworker, family member, or hated enemy you want to bore with monotonous droning, as long as you recommend it. And if you are listening on any of the streaming services this podcast is on, do drop a comment and rating to help out the show. Thank you in advance for any help, and do stay tuned for the next episode. As always, thank you for listening. Gracias y que viva bien. Adios, and goodbye for now.